Through all the tumult and the strife, I hear that music ringing. It sounds an echo in my soul. How can I keep from singing?
We will talk with the author of How Can I Keep From Singing, The Ballad of Pete Seeger, this hour. And we'll welcome your questions, your tributes, your memories of the music and activism of folk legend Pete Seeger, who passed away last week at the age of 94. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I certainly remember singing Pete Seeger's songs when I was in grade school. If I Had a Hammer, Where Have All the Flowers Gone? I didn't even know that some songs were written by Pete Seeger, like Turn, 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 made famous in my era by the Byrds. What Pete Seeger songs were most meaningful to you? Do you, like Pete Seeger, believe in the power of music to bring social change? Deep in your heart, do you believe that we shall overcome someday? 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org, or post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. You can also tweet us at Joy Cardine Show as we remember Pete Seeger. Our guest is David King Dunaway, the author of How Can I Keep From Singing, The Ballad of Pete Seeger. Our guest attended the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and he did his graduate training at the University of California, Berkeley, where he received Berkeley's first PhD in American Studies. And he joins us from San Francisco. Thank you so much for being with us.
Great to be back in Wisconsin.
Yeah, welcome back to Wisconsin via the radio. Well, what are your thoughts on the passing of Pete Seeger?
Well, it's personally hard, of course. I think Pete Seeger will be remembered for representing a different kind of America that many Americans, from what many Americans find today. He was a great believer in musical patriotism, a sense that the music that our grandfathers and our grandmothers made had some relevance to this generation. And for the baby boomers, the people in their 50s, 60s, and 70s, Pete Seeger was a kind of icon in a different way, a kind of moral compass for many. There were some for whom he was a moral pariah. But I think Pete Seeger will be remembered for his optimism and for his belief in the power of song, the power of music, to help those who have no other way of expressing themselves.
Yeah. President Obama, on the death of Pete Seeger, recalled Carl Sandburg's words and referred to Seeger as America's tuning fork. Is that how you see him?
Well, in the sense, yes, in the sense that Pete Seeger was a musical patriot. He was all about America. He was, a lot of people have condemned him for some political statements or positions that he took when he was a teenager and in his early 20s. And he died at age 94 last week, as you said, the late Pete Seeger. I'm still not getting used to the idea. But I think that he was able to bring together groups of people in a kind of musical harmony. If anyone's ever out there been to a Pete Seeger concert, they know exactly what I'm talking about. You go thinking you're going to hear this guy up on a stage, and pretty soon you're listening to the fella next to you and the girl who's sitting ahead of you because we were all singing together. And he always saw that as a kind of dominant image of what America could be, that we could work a little bit better together by singing together.
Yeah, and someone else said that Pete Seeger taught America how to sing, and that we did sing some of these songs in grade school. If I Had a Hammer, I remember that even you know, maybe even nursery school. I mean, that was, I guess we weren't thinking of the political activism when we were singing that song.
Well, Pete Seeger certainly believed for all his life that music has a kind of magic. In that sense, he was a Pied Piper for my generation. But singing for social change and actually making that change happen have always been different activities. Much as Pete tried to collapse the difference between singing and organizing, songs are not the same as ballads or bullets. A song is made of unbreakable stuff, the words and music that only need breath and spirit to live. Pete Seeger, being an American, was not tortured for his beliefs, but people did try and put him in jail. Congress approved a 10-year sentence for the guy for refusing to answer questions before the House Committee on Un-American Activities. But if you read How Can I Keep From Singing and read what Pete Seeger actually said to Congress back in 1955, I think you'll find he's saying, I'm not sure that you have the right to ask me these questions of what I believe in and where I've sung and the people who are my friends and what my political beliefs are. It's a very American Puritan sort of dissent that Pete Seeger represents. And yes, he's always believed that music had a power which was transcendent, a way of opening yourself up not just to the world through music, but of opening yourself up to community. And this is why I wrote this book, and I did a discography about Pete Seeger in a national radio series, which I think WPR may have aired at one point or another on Pete Seeger. And these are the values that I learned in Wisconsin, to be honest, the progressive tradition of Wisconsin, which is still there, of course, and which is still active. And I think that Midwestern progressivism matched the New England Puritanism in Pete Seeger.
I played an excerpt from How Can I Keep From Singing to start the show, and we'll hear some other songs as we go along this hour. But what's the story behind How Can I Keep From Singing?
Well, an old Quaker hymn, goes back hundreds of years, that a friend of Pete's up in Connecticut wrote new words to. And I always thought of it as a song that is about singing. If I can read just the words again, sometimes it's hard to get them when someone's singing. My life flows on in endless song above earth's lamentation. I hear the real, though far-off hymn that hails a new creation. Through all the tumult and the strife, I hear that music ringing. It sounds an echo in my soul. How can I keep from singing?
That's beautiful. And we should talk a little bit. I want to talk about his career and his impact, but talk about Pete Seeger's, who was Pete Seeger?
Well, his family came over on the Mayflower. He's a WASP, as some people call. He's someone who came from a family of teachers and preachers, and he grew up in the Northeast. He was sent off to boarding school very young when he was 7. His parents divorced. They were both professors at the Juilliard School of Music. So his interest in music was natural, I guess you could say. And when he was young, his parents had given proper music lessons to his 2 older children, and they didn't really take. So when they got to Pete, the 3rd son, they just gave him a ukulele and said, have fun. And he did. Mm-hmm. And he helped a lot of other Americans have fun with the instruments they found in their closets and attics. He attended Harvard University in the class of John F. Kennedy, but he dropped out. and he wanted to become a painter. He wasn't very good at it. He wanted to become a journalist. They weren't hiring a lot of journalists during the Depression when he was growing up. And so he started busking in the streets of New York, and he never looked back from that point on.
And tell us how his musical career got started and progressed.
Well, sure. It got started, you know, like so many musicians, playing guitar and banjo on the streets. Then he found a couple of little record companies that were ready to give him a break. He formed a group of, you know, like so many young people. He was in a band. The band was called the Almanac Singers, and they represented labor. They were singing songs for labor unions, and they opposed the war initially. They later changed their mind and accepted the war and began writing Beat Hitler songs. And by the time Pete Seeger was 25, he was on national radio, all four radio networks. And this was singing peace songs, Round and Round Hitler's Grave, and things like that. But then the newspapers got wind of the peace songs that he'd sung before, and it got a little challenging for them. But they kept singing, and then Pete went into the army, like so many people during World War II. He was sent off to Saipan and was responsible primarily for musical entertainment during the war. Well, that's what he did. And then when he came back, he decided that what America really needed was a singing labor movement. And so he spent a few years trying to promote labor choruses and union singing. That didn't work so well after World War II. And pretty soon he found himself without much of an audience in the blacklist era, which with Senator Joe McCarthy also has a part of Wisconsin history. And, well, he founded a group called the Weavers. Again, he was on all national radio networks, singing songs like Kisses Sweeter Than Wine and On Top of Old Smokey. Not exactly subversive songs, but the blacklist hit again. And he was told by Downbeat Magazine that he was the first band to be blacklisted out of a New York City nightclub. Well, he survived that blacklist because, and this is the way many of us met Pete Seeger, because if he couldn't sing for adults, he was still allowed to sing for kids. And in the 1950s, he started making children's records. All those little songs that you sing around the campfire, well, probably somebody learned them down the line from a Pete Seeger record, which were played in schools. And eventually, when those teenagers grew up, they went to college, and like me, they started or worked in a folk club, the folk club at the University of Wisconsin, Madison, for me. And he became very popular during the great folk boom of the 1960s. But he kept going. He was always interested in trying to find social movements that liked music. And so he was there for the civil rights movement, for the anti-war movement, which was very big, of course, in Wisconsin. He was there for Sesame Street when they started it up. It's the same guy all these years, and he's never really lost his optimism. And I think a part of America's soul may have gone, one little part, when he died.
We are talking about Pete Seeger, who passed away last week at the age of 94. Talking about Pete Seeger's life, his music, his activism. And we're welcoming your thoughts, your memories, the Pete Seeger songs that were most meaningful to you. 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
As I was walking that ribbon of highway,
as I was walking that ribbon of highway, I saw a love
in the skyway.
That endless skyway,
below me,
I saw below.
was Pete Seeger and many, many of his friends at Madison Square Garden, I believe, on the occasion of his 90th birthday. We are talking about Pete Seeger, the late Pete Seeger. Pete Seeger passed away last Monday at the age of 94. We are talking with biographer David King Dunaway. He is the author of How Can I Keep From Singing? The Ballad of Pete Seeger. And we're welcoming your questions for our guest about Pete Seeger, and we're welcoming your memories of the music and the politics of Pete Seeger. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org or post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. So, David, This Land Is Your Land, that was a Woody Guthrie song, not Pete Seeger's song. Is that right?
Well, Pete Seeger popularized it, certainly, and he added a couple of verses to it that he sometimes sings. Woody Guthrie, of course, the great American balladeer from Oklahoma, who ran into Pete Seeger at a concert. Pete Seeger said his first concert, he was a bust. He could barely move his fingers on the banjo. He froze up. It's kind of nice to hear these things, these stories. Mm-hmm. But that night in March 1940, he met Woody Guthrie, and pretty soon they were all traveling across the South, across the Midwest. Pete Seeger wrote his first song with Woody on that trip in 1940, the 66 Highway Blues. And Pete Seeger is probably responsible, as much as anyone, for reminding us of some of the great American musicians of the immediate past, like Woody Guthrie, like Leadbelly or Hootie Ledbetter. So he was a part of the song in the sense that he brought it to Americans and taught them the words. In fact, he taught us the words to a lot of songs.
He sure did. And he was active and singing, probably even months before he passed away. I mean, that was his 90th birthday, and he was still out there.
Well, Pete Seeger won two Grammys. One of them was Pete Seeger at 89. At that age, almost all musicians have pretty much lost their voice, and Pete Seeger had lost his voice. But to understand Pete Seeger is to understand, well, what my friend Country Joe McDonald once told me. Pete Seeger could get up on the stage and play the chair, and I wouldn't care. He was not just a musician. He used to say, if music alone could change the world, I'd only be a musician. He was as interested in provoking you to think about your times and what that meant, about the future of humankind and what that meant, and what we were going to do about the environment and what we were going to do to make a more just society.
We are talking with David King Dunaway, author of How Can I Keep From Singing? The Ballad of Pete Seeger. Our number is 1-800-642-1234. You can also email a question, comment, or memory about Pete Seeger to talk@wpr.org. Taylor in Rushford, Minnesota is with us. Hi, Taylor.
Hi, thanks for the show. This is awesome. I just wanted to share a quick memory I had about Pete Seeger. One of the earliest times I learned about Pete Seeger was I came across a song he had sung called What Did You Learn in School Today? And I was probably 16 or 17, and at the time I just kind of thought it was a satirical song. But after I got a little bit older and I always listened to it every now and again, I came to realize that Pete Seeger was telling me to question everything, whether I had already had a firm belief in it. He always kind of taught me that, or the song always kind of, reminded me to question things, whether I had a firm belief and understanding of them or not. And that's one thing I'll always be thankful to that song and to Pete Seeger for.
Hold on, Taylor. Let me and David. Let's take a listen to an excerpt from the song. Bill Martin's my director has pulled it up. Let's take a listen.
What did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine? What did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine? I learned that Washington never told a lie. I learned that soldiers seldom die. I learned that everybody's free. And that's what the teacher said to me. That's what I learned in school today. That's what I learned in school.
Interesting. David, a response?
Well, that song is actually written by Tom Paxton, and who's still alive, who's still a great songwriter. He has given us many good songs, and I think that's what, to understand that song and understand that Pete sang it, is to understand that Pete channeled other musicians. He was always a very generous performer who was willing to, well, make hits of other people's songs and not care too much about the ones he himself did. So yeah, it's a little bit, has the song with a little bit of a bite to it. But that's an old American tradition where we sing about the world we live in. And yeah, sometimes the news isn't great.
Yeah, this was a song that I remember way, way back when. And I have to admit, I think it was during the late 60s. I was still in grade school at that time, but aware. And I thought it was a Kingston Trio song from way back when, that was turned into a Vietnam War protest song. And here's Pete Seeger singing "Where Have All the Flowers Gone."
Where have all the flowers gone? Long time passing. Where have all the flowers gone? Long time ago. Where have all the flowers gone? The girls have picked them, everyone. Oh, when will you ever learn? Oh, when will you ever learn?
And I remember people saying that that was one of the first anti-war songs, David, was it?
Oh, no. We've had anti-war songs since the 19th century. As a matter of fact, Pete's dad, Charles Seeger, was very much opposed to our participation in World War I, and he was blacklisted. His dad was blacklisted from Berkeley, where he was the youngest full professor in the history of the University of California, even to this day. He started the music department at Berkeley. Well, America has always had a tradition of singing out for social dissent. I wrote another book called Singing Out, A History of America's Folk Music. And it talks a little bit about this tradition that we always have expressed our ideas in musical form. When we weren't that literate, when we didn't have compulsory education, well, anybody could make up words to a song, particularly if you had the tune. You could just make up your own words. And you're singing it to yourself, and pretty soon if the good words, someone else is singing it alongside you. And that tradition, yes, has an anti-war part to it. Last night I had the strangest dream.
All right.
You know?
Let's take another call from Art in Milwaukee. Hello, Art.
Hi. Thanks for the show. And for anyone who can make it, they should go to see Woody Says that the Milwaukee Rep is doing through March 9th. On a lot of references to Pete as well about Woody Guthrie. So I'll tell you one story, and I'll tell you a favorite song or two. So the late Saul Landau, who passed away, Emmy Award-winning filmmaker, was a student at Madison, UW. In the late 50s, he was part of a group, I think it was the Labor Youth League, and he told us that they brought Pete Seeger, but there was apparently some rule that you couldn't mix politics with culture, so they had to bring him as being a political presenter and not a cultural presenter. And when he came, they said, well, when you sing, please talk about your songs as much as you can so that it'll come off as you're presenting a political point of view. And he said, I'm going to do what I'm going to do. And they were suspended because they had violated this rule because they couldn't mix politics with culture. I was in Arizona last week listening to Arizona Public Radio. They had a beautiful tribute to Pete Seeger. We're on the way to visit a political prisoner there. And they sang a song of his called Garbage, which is on his last album, they said, called Pete. And it goes from pollution to our mass media and the kind of garbage we've got. It's really moving. But probably my favorite, besides Where Have All the Flowers Gone, is Turn, 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 because it really gives people a sense to have their own emotions at the right time in their lives.
Thank you very much, Art, for sharing those memories, those songs. And I'm wondering, David, Garbage, he did turn a lot to environmental causes and activism later in his life, didn't he?
Well, there's a connection between all these things, as there so often is. Pete Seeger was working in the civil rights movement in the South. And around about 1965, that movement changed, and it became not we're all in it together, but we're fighting for our home and our rights. And when that happened, a black activist came up to Pete and said, well, what's going on in your home, in your community? What struggles are you fighting there? You're down here in the South, but what about up north? And it had a profound effect on him, and he decided that he needed to integrate much, much better with his own community. And the way he ended up doing that was by starting the Clearwater Project, which was to create a replica of an old sloop that used to sail the river when it was full of the Hudson River, when it was full of sturgeon, and it was a very clean and beautiful river. At the time Pete started, you couldn't stick your leg in there without getting burnt from the chemicals. Well, a lot of people made fun of him, but I think this is really the first one of the first chapters with Rachel Carson's book in America's environmental movement, is the desire to reclaim our rivers, our lakes, our streams. And Pete Seeger was right there in 1965, a long time ago, reminding us that this was the heritage we're passing on to our children. And he never veered from this notion of the importance of the environment and the importance of taking a step and taking an action and realizing that you have power to do these things. Just a matter of getting yourself set for it and committing yourself to it and being in it for the long haul. And he certainly was in it in the long haul, that's for sure.
Yeah. So you had to separate politics and culture at UW-Milwaukee, apparently. How can you do that?
Boy, that's a good one. We fortunately, when I was at UW-Madison in the late 60s, nobody was asking us to separate politics and culture. I don't think Pete Seeger could have any more than many Native Americans could separate religion from the texture of the things they do in their daily lives. I think that culture is, well, there was a saying back when Pete was growing up that culture was a weapon in the fight against fascism. And I think culture is something that people have some unusual thoughts about, you know? Culture's when you go to a fancy museum. Culture's when some highbrow reads a book in the corner. But Pete Seeger was very, very much opposed to that notion of culture. He said culture is the music that you make, that your parents made, that your grandparents made. Culture is that little drawing you did when you were three. It might not have been too good, but it was a process of understanding where you came from and how you saw the world. Somebody said that Pete Seeger was our music teacher. You know, after we had learned to hate music in school, we found Pete Seeger, and he taught us what it was about. This person, Mike Cooney, said, and it goes beyond that to the environment. Even the fish in the sea and the birds in the air would thank him if they knew the work that he had done or started. And that's another thing to bring out about Pete Seeger. There's an awful lot of great musicians, people who are great, inspiring people. But there's not a lot of people that can make that jump from cultural production to social and community organizing. And Pete Seeger did that. He didn't just sing songs about how dirty the river was, he and, of course, his longtime partner, Toshi Ota Seeger, his wife of 65 years, formed the coalitions and formed the groups and took the patience of sitting down there with rich people that he didn't particularly care to sit with because they were more into yachts than bringing back the clean water on the Hudson. And he took those years that it took to build something and make it last.
We're going to need to take a break very soon, but since Art said that his favorite songs included Where Have All the Flowers Gone, which we talked a little bit about, and Turn, 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 I want to play the Birds' Turn, 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 but can you tell us about that song and how Pete Seeger wrote it?
Pete and Toshi, as a matter of fact, he took verses from the old preacher, Ecclesiastes in the Bible, and set them to music because he was a composer. We can lose sight of that. He wrote song tunes as well as song lyrics. And it became a song that allowed him to talk about the many things, many sides of life today, and all the choices that we make, a time for this and a time for that. And when the Birds did it, a lot of people thought Pete Seeger would have a lot of problem with the electric behind it. But he said no, it harmonized beautifully with his own version.
We'll hear a little bit of the Birds and Turn, Turn, Turn as we go to break. We are talking about Pete Seeger with one of his biographer, David King Dunaway. Author of How Can I Keep From Singing, The Ballad of Pete Seeger. And welcoming your questions for him. We're welcoming any favorite songs you might have. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.
A time to heal, a time to have, a time. To everything, turn, turn, turn. There is a season, turn, turn, turn.
We shall overcome. We shall overcome. We shall.
Talking about the life, the legacy, the music, the impact on social issues, political issues. Pete Seeger, folk singer Pete Seeger, died last week at the age of 94. We are talking with biographer David King Dunaway. His book, How Can I Keep From Singing? The Ballad of Pete Seeger. David is a graduate of the University of Wisconsin-Madison, did his graduate training at the University of California, Berkeley, where he received Berkeley's first PhD in American Studies. And he's talking with us from San Francisco. And David, boy, talk about the theme of the civil rights movement, We Shall Overcome, and that was a Pete Seeger song.
Well, like so many songs, it's a song that he made a major contribution to and popularized. Originally, in the 1940s, it was recorded as an old spiritual, I'll Overcome. But some tobacco workers that were on strike got the idea that they could change that I to we, and that not only would you overcome when you died and went to heaven, you could overcome right here. You could change things. And Pete then passed it. It was Pete learned the song. He rearranged the melody a bit. He changed it to I Shall Overcome instead of I Will Overcome and taught it to a lot of people, folk singers in the 50s. And pretty soon it came back to the South. A song that started in the South, went north, went out to California, got changed around a little. And it became, as you say, the anthem of America's African-American civil rights movements. It's important to remember there were many others, the Hispanic civil rights movement, a Red Power movement for Native Americans and Indians, one of many. And Pete Seeger and Bob Dylan this time, not Woody. Woody had passed pretty much. He'd gone into the hospital with his Huntington's chorea. But Pete Seeger went down to the South and found himself singing that song wherever he went.
You know, members of the participants of the Solidarity Sing-Along at the Madison State Capitol building, they have been singing during noon hours various protest songs. Boy, for the past couple of years now, ever since the Act 10 legislation in Wisconsin. And they are paying tribute to Pete Seeger this week. And I saw a video of members of the Solidarity Sing-Along singing Solidarity Together. Pete Seeger was a big union supporter.
He certainly was. You know, a lot of people can forget where this union movement came from. 100 years ago, we were looking at 6-day weeks, very often 10-hour days, and it was a labor movement that began the idea of 8 hours for work, 8 hours for sleep, 8 hours for what you will. And that's about 125 years ago when we began that movement, and it has changed America. It has changed the way we live. We're no longer working necessarily 6-day weeks as a requirement of picking up a job. We forget all the good things that we've gotten. That's often the case. And yes, Pete Seeger was very engaged by the labor movement when he was in his 20s. It was probably the closest thing to a religion that he had.
Let's take a call from Michael in Bear Valley. Hello, Michael.
Oh, hello, Dave and Joy. Thank you so much for this show. This has been kind of a difficult week for me. I knew Pete. In my early 20s, I had an opportunity to work on a film called A Song and a Stone, which was a documentary film about Pete Seeger. And I had an opportunity to be up at his cabin in Beacon and meet Toshi. And I just wanted, David, to talk just a little bit about Pete's lifestyle. One of the things that I don't think a lot of people realize is that he really lived what he talked about. And interesting combination in a person of romanticism and courage. He built a cabin up in Beacon, and as I recall, the land that he lived on was actually Rockefeller land that they let him use. I was wondering if you'd just talk a little bit about that, his simple lifestyle and how he kind of plugged into another time. When I was there, I felt like I was really living in another time of America. And the last thing, as far as the song request goes, is that Pete and Bob Dylan and Arlo sang to Woody Guthrie when he was dying a song called Go to Sleep, My Weary Hobo. And I thought maybe you could try to find that and play that tune. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you very much. We'll see what Bill can do. But you want to talk about Pete Seeger's lifestyle?
Sure. Mm-hmm. By the time that the late 40s rolled around, Pete Seeger had had enough of running around New York City. And he decided that he needed to get back to the river country where his family lived. In upstate New York, and he bought a small piece of property, and as he said, I showed the value of a college education. I went to the library and looked up LOGCABIN, and I built one.
Mm-hmm.
And he lived there in a very modest style. I remember seeing the old Volkswagen Bug that Pete Seeger used to drive at the time when his songs were number one on the hit parade. Pete was always embarrassed at the funds that came his way briefly during the great folk boom. He didn't want money. He wanted people to think and vote and participate and sing. And so he lived very modestly. You know, he grew his own had a little garden where he and Toshi grew their vegetables. He would chop his own wood. He had a big wood stove, and they had a few acres of woods, and they'd go out every morning and pull down some logs and chop them out. He continued that even until this year. He used to tell me, Dave, people need to get out of breath once a day, no matter what they do. And I think he managed to live in a way that reflected the values that he had. He once confessed to me, you know, sometimes I wish that I'd called myself Uncle Zeke, because then Uncle Zeke could get up there and do a show like everybody else, and then he could go home and be himself. But he committed himself very early on to living the life that he sang in his songs. And that's not always easy, because as Holly Near, a musician activist from Northern California, also commented in the new edition of my book, because I wrote this a long time ago, and then I redid it a few years back. She said, you know, a lot of the musicians are there to do their show and then go on back for the beer. But not Pete Seeger. He was as interested in the way people would live in the future and the things they would remember out of what he did and the way that he could create a sense of idealism as he was in that beer.
Well, we did find the song, but I don't think we have an appropriate spot to play right now. So maybe we'll save that till the end, as we have other callers waiting and other comments to get to. Gary on Facebook writes, "Be prepared. The reactionary right wing is now throwing all sorts of dirt on Seeger for his political stance when he was younger. He apparently brainwashed us all." Saying be prepared for a lot of negative comments. Now, we haven't heard those really so far during this hour, David, but you mentioned that to some he was a political pariah.
Well, he certainly would. I even have a little picture of in the book there of a flyer that I got years ago. It shows a hammer and sickle, and it shows Pete Seeger, and it says Khrushchev's songbird. Well, okay. He definitely supported the Soviet Union. He definitely did join the Communist Party when he was 16 or 17 during the height of the Depression. There's no question about that. And he also was very late in realizing the serious crimes that were committed in the Soviet Union. He ended up writing a tune called The Big Joe Blues about Stalin back in 2007. He always took a political stance. His dad was very political. He always felt that there was no separating out, as we learned from another caller earlier, politics and culture. That in every cultural act, perhaps, there was an implicit political statement. And he wasn't afraid to make them. I might mention that some of the material that I've gathered over the years, by the way, is available at PeteSeeger.org. And I can't say that it tells the entire story of his politics on that website, but there's a big old book that tells about the history of his times, and that's what I tried to do, to give people a sense for who he was and what his context was, so that you don't just have these labels thrown at him.
Yeah. Let's take a listen to another excerpt from a song that I have. This is My Old Brown Earth, and I understand Pete won a Grammy for this. Let's take a listen.
To my old brown earth and to my old blue sky, I'll now give these last few molecules of I.
So did he get a Grammy for that?
And he did. You know, Pete Seeger was blacklisted for 17 years, from 1950 to 1967. He could not appear on American television. Many, many people tried to get him on during that folk boom. So his recognition came a little late, well, a lot late, if you will. So he had to wait from 67 to about 97 before he could receive a Grammy or anything of that sort. He was kept away from the mainstream of American media. And it was only places like Wisconsin, like Oberlin, places where people were more tolerant, perhaps we could say, or maybe a little distrustful of the right-wing prejudice against Seeger, the way they thought they could dismiss his music, because as a teenager he joined the perfectly legal Communist Party during the Depression. It's always been a bit of a burden, as well as his signature, that his music has always been connected with the social movements of his time. But he wouldn't have had it any other way, Joy.
We have a listener who says, Pete Seeger introduced her to the Spanish language and music from around the world. And perhaps she's thinking of this song.
Guantanamera, Guajira, Guantanamera, Guantanamera, Guajira, Guantanamera.
Oh, yeah, I remember that song. So, Guantanamera, a quick story about that?
Yeah, it's a Cuban song by written by a Cuban exile living in upstate New York, of all things, when he wrote that tune. Pete Seeger put new words to it. As a matter of fact, I recorded the song from my camp counselor when I was in about 15 years old and sent the words to Pete, who then popularized it and returned it even to Cuba, where the song had not been sung. It's a song about hope. It's a song about the power of music and words. And what else would Pete Seeger be singing?
Joel and Phillips, almost out of time, Joel. Please go ahead.
Hi. I was just wondering, America still needs a voice. And I'm wondering, do you think there's any musicians nowadays that are going to step up and try and fill Pete's big shoes?
What do you think, David?
I think there are many. I think they're out there now. They're practicing in their garage. They're trying to get their chops together. They're trying to get their friends together. They're trying to remember a new way of presenting old stories in music. They're out there. We're going to be hearing from them, and I hope they'll be on Joy's show.
I hope so, too. And maybe just a couple of final thoughts on how Pete Seeger is going to be remembered.
Well, I think he will be remembered as a man who had, as a musical patriot, as a man who was very controversial in his time because he just wouldn't shut up when a lot of Americans did. He was a tall, skinny figure, a very principled man who believed in the power of music to remind us of where we came from and help us find a better way into the future.
Thank you so much for being with us. David King Dunaway is author of How Can I Keep From Singing? And we'll hear just a little bit of the song Go to Sleep, My Hobo.
Now don't you worry about tomorrow.